Okay, so what we've discussed is the problem of actually estimating motion, which I hope you'll take to be typical of the more general problem of estimating any feature of the visual world. You can think about the problem of estimating the pitch of a complex sound or a variety of different problems. And people have tried to do sort of parallel things, which we could talk about if you're interested. But what I want to do now, imagine that you had gone through something like this for a variety of different problems. So you could do the estimation of motion in the visual system, the estimation of pitch or the direction of a sound in the auditory system, some aspect of the texture of an object in the somatosensory system, something like this. The difficulty, of course, is that, I mean, it's nice to be able to formulate these problems as not as detailed models of how the particular neural circuitry works, but rather as problems in the processing of signals that have certain physical limitations. The difficulty is that you end up with a sort of laundry list, right? I mean, if you have a theory, if you say, well, the nervous system can do a very good job at estimating this feature, and it can do a very good job at estimating that feature, a very good job of estimating that feature, then you make a list of all these things, and you go through these sorts of arguments for every single one, and, you know, locally it's sort of satisfying because you actually compute something that is relevant to how the nervous system works. But globally, it's not terribly satisfying because you just have this long list. And then someday somebody will tell you, no. Actually, there's this other feature that the system's really good at extracting, so you should make a theory of that too. And so the question is, can you do anything more general? And so there's an idea that goes back to the 1950s, that maybe what the nervous system is trying to do is to build an efficient representation of the signals that it's taking in. And in particular, there's the idea that what you mean by efficient representation, that you could quantify this using information theory. Now, let me give you an example of what it means to generate an efficient representation of data that's not the conventional one in this context. But it's one that with which I think you're all familiar, and I'll tell you what information theory has to do with it. So okay. You observe data that looks like this. Now, you all know that in some sense, without even telling you what problem it is you're supposed to do, it would be useful for you to observe that the data comes in four clusters. Which are centered like this. And in some intuitive sense, the recognition that you have these clusters represents an understanding of the data. Now, what does this have to do with the notion of efficient representation? Well, if I want to tell you where every data point is, it takes a lot of bits to write down the coordinates, x and y, to the precision with which I place the dots, right? The dots live in a box about this size. It looks like I place the dots to a precision of perhaps 1/30th, right, on each side. So that means 1,000 altogether. So it takes 10 bits to describe the location of a dot to within the accuracy that I drew it. On the other hand, if I tell you it came from this cluster, then I've narrowed my uncertainty tremendously, right? And in fact, I'm pretty close to telling you where the dot was. But there's only 4 clusters, and in fact, they're not even equally populated, so that only takes less than 2 bits, right? So there's a picture that says, how many bits are you going to use to describe the point for me? And what's your mean square error in locating the point on the plane? And there's some curve that looks like this. And this region in here is forbidden, right? If I only give you a certain number of bits, then there's a limit to how accurately you can actually tell me where the thing is. But it's quite striking that in this problem, for example, sort of goes like this, right? So somewhere out here at 10 bits, I get to, you know, an error bar that looks like that. But down here, somewhere at around 2 bits, my error bar is actually only a little bigger, right? On average. If I ask you, what's the RMS error? What's the RMS deviation between the points and the center of the cluster? It's not that big. So what this means is that you can squeeze out actually 80% of the bits and lose only a very tiny bit of precision in describing where the points are. So there's a sense, which this makes precise, where a representation of these data in terms of which cluster the point belongs to is much more efficient than telling you where the points are. Okay? And interestingly, in this case, there is a correspondence between the technical statement, provide an efficient representation in the sense that you use as few bits and that you use as few bits as possible, with your sort of intuitive notion of what it means to understand the data, which is to recognize that there are these clusters. Okay? So what, although they didn't use this example, what Barlow and Atneev, and Barlow actually has a series of really insightful papers on all of this, in the late 1950s. What they suggested was, in modern language, that this example is prototypical. That is to say, if I forced you to take sensory data and provide a representation of those data that was efficient in an information theoretic sense, you would in fact discover the structures that are the stuff of our perceptions. Right? When you look at these data, you say to yourself, ah, they're clustered. That's the salient fact. And I can make you discover that by insisting that you give me an efficient representation of the data in the sense that I want to drive you down onto this curve where you use your bits as efficiently as possible, and then I want you to squeeze down. Well, so there's a piece in here where, well, I mean, we could actually work out the details, right? The curves got kinks in it and stuff, right? So, for example, down here where you have zero bits, right, that's where you just say one big cluster, and then when you distinguish two clusters, you sort of get out to one bit, and that drops you down some finite amount. And then, given that you're only going to use two clusters, you can still add a fraction of a bit by specifying things a little more, by shifting the probabilities of how you use the clusters, and so on. So there are actually kinks in the curve. What I was trying to draw attention to here is that basically once you've got the four clusters, somewhere here around two bits, there's only so much improvement you can get, and presumably that comes gradually. So actually, if you want to do that, well, okay. There's a variety of ways of thinking about it. So that was the idea. Maybe the goal of the nervous system is to build an efficient representation. And this could mean several different things. So one idea is you could take signals. So how are you going to do this, right? I've given you an example where building an efficient representation means clustering. And of course, that is very relevant to problems that the nervous system solves. You can argue that the problem of invariant object recognition or face recognition is in part a problem of clustering. You have many, many different images, all of which need to be given the same name. Right? And presumably this works because there really is a sort of compact region in the space of images that corresponds to all the different views of the same object or all the different views of the same person, even if we don't quite know how to find it explicitly. So at a very high level, this business of clustering really does have one problem with chalk dust. Really does have something to do with our perceptions. But another idea, which is a much more low-level problem, is that when you look at the signals in adjacent photoreceptors, they're very correlated with each other, just because of the spatial correlations of the scenes in front of you. So one thing you might do, right, if you're trying to make an efficient representation of data, one thing you shouldn't do is write the same number down over and over again. Right? That's clearly not efficient. So one thing you could do is just to make sure that the numbers that you write down, for example, the signals that come at the output of the retina, are as nearly independent of each other as you can make them. That's a hypothesis, right? And then that will serve to increase the efficiency of the representation, because then what you're doing with each neuron, right, becomes independent of everything else. So the variations in the signals from each neuron can give you more information given the same dynamic range, because they're not wasted writing down the same number that the neighboring neuron told you. So one way to do this is to take the signals that you get and just filter them so that this simple two-point correlations go away. Okay? So you know, for example, that if you have a correlation function that looks like this, then if you do something, so if you have a signal, let's call it phi of x, right? And let's say this goes like that, like what I've drawn here. Then if I consider the signal psi, which is that, then you can easily convince yourself that that's true. So I can take signals that are correlated, and just by some combination of linear operations, I can turn them into signals that are uncorrelated. Okay? So what Barlow realized right away is that at some level, this is the kind of thing that's happening in the retina, because you know that in the retina, you have these famous center surround receptive fields, which serve essentially to do a form of differentiation, right? If this area balances those areas, then this thing is a smeared out derivative. And so as with signals that are correlated like this, if you apply an operator like this to the signals in the real world, you'll find that the output of that is much less correlated than the input was. Okay? So that's a nice idea that maybe part of why the visual system does this at an early stage is to make the signals at different ganglion cells, the output of the retina, more independent of each other than the signals at neighboring photoreceptors. Okay? And in that sense, the representation of signals in ganglion cells is much more efficient than the representation of signals in photoreceptors. Is that clear? Right, so you should imagine taking this and convolving it with the image and then sampling again, right? So you had an image which you sampled at the level of the photoreceptors, now smear it, now take that sampled image, pass it through something like this, and sample again. The resulting samples will be more independent of each other than the first set. No, because I could also use fewer bits at every sample point. And in fact, you know that at the time, people were worried about the fact that photoreceptors give you analog signals, and the ganglion cells give you spikes. So maybe there's already a reduction in capacity there. It's also true that if you look at the retina as a whole, the number of ganglion cells is very much smaller than the number of photoreceptors. And this is sometimes pointed to as being the obvious reason behind this kind of argument. This is slightly misleading because the sampling is very inhomogeneous. So for example, in your fovea, there are actually more ganglion cells than cones. Not by much, but by a factor of about 2. So that notion of having to do a compression because you have fewer channels is, you have to be careful about. In some regions of the retina, that's probably true. But on the other hand, those are also regions of the retina where you probably throw away spatial resolution. So, okay. So this is one set of ideas. And so you can see where this goes, right? What you're going to try and do is to make a model of what a neuron can do. So you have photoreceptors. And maybe your model is that to get to the ganglion cells, that what you have is just a perceptron, right? Or maybe even something simpler than that. So you have weights with which you collect signals from the photoreceptors and then report that weighted sum, maybe through some nonlinearity. And then you make a hypothesis about the images that are falling on the retina, about the statistical structure of those images. And then you could ask, well, and then to make the problem well posed, let's assume that there's a little bit of noise in here, right? Because if there isn't, then any invertible transformation is as good as any other, right? So if I take a linear transformation of my data that I can invert, then I haven't actually done anything, right? Is that clear? This is actually a source of some confusion. A lot of people think that filtering intrinsically changes something. It doesn't, right? If I take a signal and I filter it, and I look at the filtered signal, I can always undo the operation of the filter. What you can't undo is if you have a filter and then a little bit of noise gets added afterwards. Because if you try to undo the filtering operation, then you'll end up amplifying the noise. Okay? So if you imagine that ganglion cells aren't perfectly reliable, a little bit of noise in them, then you do this linear transformation. As I say, maybe you have a model that there's some nonlinearity here. And now you could ask, how do I arrange these weights so that the information that the ganglion cell provides about these visual inputs is as large as possible? And it's clear that in doing that calculation, you're going to have to keep track of the fact that different ganglion cells are in general correlated with each other. And so the information that they give as a group is less than the information they would give individually. But if you could make them independent, then the information would be the same, right? So this is a class of theoretical problems that you can then formulate and try and solve. And of course, you know, 30 years later, what you realize is that if you do all this and are very careful, what you get is Barlow's intuition, which is that you should build these center surround filters. Of course, what you can't get by intuition is what the widths should be. It's also not clear that you get them right, but okay, if you do an honest calculation, then this width comes out, has to come from someplace, right? Some combination of the noise level and the correlations in the images will determine what this scale is. It's not clear whether that's a correct prediction, but at least you know where it comes from. So this is one set of ideas that have been explored a great deal. Another set of ideas is, which has been explored less, is very simple. Is the use of adjusting your nonlinear input-output relation to fill up the dynamic range of your outputs. So, sure. So there are various formulations. Okay, one simple one is maximize the information that the ganglion cells provide about images subject to some constraint on the dynamic range of ganglion cell outputs, let's say. Okay, so firing rates can't get too big or something. Okay, another formulation would be just make them as independent as possible. Right, so minimize the redundancy. That is to say, I don't know what it is that sets the amount of information carried by one ganglion cell, but I want to make sure that I get as close as possible to the idea that if I use n ganglion cells, I get n times as much information. The details are different, but the qualitative answer is the same. And it may be that the answer is sufficiently, the comparison with experiment is sufficiently qualitative that you can't tell the difference. Might be. I mean, that's an argument. Okay? So another idea is that you want to arrange your input-output relations so that you fill up your dynamic range. So here's a simple example. And this, of course, has many origins. But in particular, there was a beautiful paper by Laughlin in, is it 81 or 71 already? It's a long time ago. I think it's actually in the 70s. Sorry, I don't remember the reference. By the way, I'm being rather cavalier about references and things. So if you're curious about a reference, just ask me. And I do actually respond to email. Telephone is hopeless. So he did he made the following observation. He said, look, if I go out in the outside world and I measure I make a photodetector whose aperture is matched to the fly photoreceptors, then what I discover is that the intensity of light comes from some probability distribution. Wander around in the world, has some characteristic shape. Of course, it depends on the time of day, right? And he said, look, at some level in the visual system, this signal gets translated into a voltage in some cell, in the photoreceptors and then in the second order neurons, which are called large monopolar cells. Doesn't matter what the name is. So how do I convert intensity into a voltage in a way that makes efficient use of the voltages? And so the idea is very simple. We'll be formal about it in just a second. But the voltage in a cell, right, has to there's a maximum and a minimum, right? Remember that the voltages across cell membranes are determined by differences in ionic concentration. There are pumps that maintain these things. And then when you want to get a signal, you change the number of ion channels that are open. The ion channels are selective for different ions. And so if you open a huge conductance for potassium, then the voltage will go to the potassium equilibrium potential. If you open a huge conductance for sodium, it'll go to the sodium equilibrium potential. And that's it. You know, you can't really get outside that range. So he said, look, we know that voltages are confined to some finite range. How do I map intensities into voltages in a way that makes efficient use of that range? Well, what do we mean by efficient use? We'll get the right information theoretic way of saying it in just a second, but one way of saying it is that I would like to have as many different voltages that I can distinguish used as possible, right? So I've got a certain range of voltages, and you might imagine, let's say you have 50 millivolts to work with, let's imagine that you can detect a 1 millivolt difference. Well, then in that case, there are 50 steps. You'd like to use them all. If the mapping from intensity to voltage is too steep, then you never use the extremes, right? Or sorry, you never use the intermediate values, right? So if here you'll go to here, and here you'll go to here, but the question is, what happens in here? You'd like to be sure that you stretch this out so that you use all of the values of the voltage more or less equally, right? So this, in image processing, this is called histogram equalization, but the term didn't exist at the time. So is this clear, right? You don't want to have values of the voltage you never use, because that could have stood for something, but you never use it. So to be efficient, what you'd like to do is have the probability of the voltage be approximately constant. But remember that the voltage and the current and the intensity are related to each other. So P of V dV has to be P of I dI. But of course, if this is constant, this is the distribution that you measure, and then this is a differential equation that you just integrate to find out how the voltage should depend on the intensity. So what you get is that the voltage should be the integral of the probability. Okay? So what's interesting is that this makes it, this basically allows you to match. I mean, your input-output relation has some nonlinear form, and it's got a dynamic range to it, right? It can only go this far, and it goes from being pinned at one end to being pinned at the other end, and to being pinned at the other end over some range of intensities. And what this serves to do is to match that range of intensities to the range of intensities in the outside world in such a way that you maximize the efficiency with which you use the voltage range. What was amazing was that Laughlin went out then and just studied the response of these second-order neurons in the fly visual system to flashes of light at different intensities. And, I mean, it's not obvious, for example, that the accuracy with which you can measure the voltage is constant, right? Nor is it obvious that when you measure the response to a flash of light, you should just take the peak and call that the response. But nonetheless, there are no free parameters, right? So if you tell me, let's call the response the peak of the flash response, then there are no free parameters. This curve is drawn from this one with no adjustments. And amazingly enough, the data fit spectacularly well. So in the same way that filtering can be used to remove spatial correlations, to match the sort of two-point correlation structure of the input, you can choose your nonlinear input-output relations in such a way as to match the probability distribution of signals at one point, which is also not a trivial matter. Okay? Now, actually, some of you probably know about techniques like independent component analysis. And a lot of these techniques are based, in some sense, on a sort of mixing of these ideas, that you're trying to do a combination of filtering and nonlinear sort of squashing to generate more efficient representations at the output. And if you think about it, if your inputs consist of pieces which are independent of each other that somehow have been mixed together, so for example, if we all talk at once and we hang one microphone, then what you have is a large number of approximately independent signals that have all been mixed together. If I could find a way of if I just write down the signal at every instant of time, there are of course lots of correlations. Because what you have is each one of us is saying something, I hope, that's correlated over time. And these are all on top of each other. So the correlation functions just add, right? So the correlations actually kind of get fatter and fatter. On the other hand, if we could break the signal apart into its independent pieces, then we'd have a much more efficient representation, because the pieces would be independent of each other, right? And so the idea is that you can try and solve these problems of source separation by combining these sorts of techniques. Okay. And again, those are problems that, to some extent, the nervous system is capable of solving. So there are these intuitive ideas about the efficiency of representation. They have connections to very specific sort of models of what neurons are doing and experiments. They also have connections to sort of practical algorithms like these independent components business. I should say that people have taken these ideas not only to think about the retina, but to think further up and try and think about visual cortex and so on. I find it a little less compelling, but nonetheless, it's an interesting business. How would we figure out whether we were on the right track? Yeah.
What are the failures to this approach? So we always hear about successes, but I don't think the biologists can handle biology in the efficient.
Right. Well, it's also true that the subset of biologists who managed to show that the visual system could count single photons was epsilon compared to the ones who studied the visual system, right? So you have to be a little careful when they tell you it's not efficient. I think the major failings of this approach are actually theoretical. So the most dramatic thing that I think is wrong is that what people have done, let's say in something like this, they find the optimal receptive fields for ganglion cells. And of course, they always look like the real receptive fields of ganglion cells, somehow, by the time they publish the paper. There's only one problem. There are many different kinds of ganglion cells. Right? In fact, there are more than most people admit. So you look in the textbook and they'll tell you that, you know, in a mammal there are three kinds. You know, say in a cat, right? X, Y, and W. And of course, this is what distinguishes mammals from lower vertebrates, which have more different types. Okay. So first of all, center surround organization was discovered in a lower vertebrate retina first. So if this is the explanation, then you have to deal with the lower vertebrate retinas that have many different types of ganglion cells, even in the textbooks. Then if you actually look at the literature, people are starting to claim that, in fact, there are more different types of ganglion cells, even in mammals. So I think this business of always showing that there is a set of receptive, you know, a receptive field, which is the optimal solution, sort of fundamentally misses the fact that retinas are built with many different types of ganglion cells. And so what hasn't happened, as far as I know, is to take one of these theoretical approaches and find a solution to the optimization problem that corresponds to a diversity of cell types. And I believe that that's not because no such solution exists. I think it's just people haven't looked for it. So it seems to me that something that would be compelling in terms of explaining things about biology would be to say, I've solved this optimization problem, and there ought to be five different kinds of cells. There's this one that you know about, this one that you know about, this one that you know about, and this one, which has some features in common with type, you know, the fifth one could easily be mistaken for type number four if you didn't do the right experiment. But actually, if you do this experiment, you'll tell them apart, right? That hasn't happened. So in that sense, I think that in a deep way, we haven't advanced in this line. We haven't advanced beyond what Barlow said in 1961. I mean, we formalized it, but I don't know that we've gotten terribly far. So it's a very pretty idea, but it's tough to make progress. And I think that one of the reasons so is it clear what the situation is here? I mean, these are nice ideas, but the way in which you're supposed to compare to experiment is kind of complicated. So you assume something about the statistical structure of the world. Almost certainly those assumptions are wrong. Right? The world's a complicated place. It's hard to, nobody knows how to write down this probability distribution. You then assume something about what the neurons up to some level in the visual system are capable of doing. This is also presumably wrong. Within this, you optimize what the neurons are doing, and out comes some characterization of what these neurons are like, which in many cases, I think is a little too much listening to the biologists and saying they tell me that I'm supposed to characterize neurons in this way, so that's how the characterization is going to look. It would seem to me that in this approach you might hope to discover that the optimal solution is for the neurons to do something which could look like that, but is in some deep way different. And then you compare. Well, you're piling assumptions on top of each other, and then your comparison is between the characterization of your model neurons and some sort of characterization of the real neurons, and it isn't even fair that's a fair comparison. So it's a bit problematic. It's a nice idea, but it's a bit problematic. So so I think it's murky. I mean, the derivations for ganglion cells of what the receptive field should look like have a tendency to be analytic, because you can usually solve the problem with a pen. By the time you get to cortex, so what people do, I mean, one way to do it is to build multiple layers, right? So you assert that the individual layers are only capable of doing certain things. And then having gone through multiple layers, there's now more solutions available to you. But it's also true that typically those optimization things are done by having some learning algorithm that adjusts the parameters. And instead of writing down the distribution, you just sample from natural images. So several things have changed, okay? One is that you've made the problem nonlinear, and so you're searching for solutions numerically rather than analytically, which could either mean that you get stuck in local minima or that you find things you wouldn't have found with a pen. You're using samples from the real distribution as opposed to some model distribution. Okay, so
you say that this way you cannot go further than directly.
No, I mean you can try, but I actually I don't know that the comparison with experiment at the level of the retina is any more compelling today than it was when Barlow made his first observations. I think it remains a nice idea. The major problem in using this idea and going to the cortex, by the way, is that I'll remind you that in the part of visual cortex that represents your fovea, there are 30,000 neurons for every cone. In what sense is that an efficient representation? Sounds inefficient. Any naive notion of efficiency must fail. So you can calculate all the receptive fields you want to, right? And some of them will even look like the receptive fields of cells in the visual cortex. But you haven't explained why you need 30,000 neurons. Wait. So let me suggest that we should do something different, which is, instead of studying these model neurons and trying to fiddle with things, let's actually try and ask if we can directly measure the efficiency with which signals are represented in the nervous system. Because, you know, it could turn out that we're just completely on the wrong track, right? The efficiency is very low. And that's not true, but I think we'll see something along the way. So, what do I want to do? I'm going to play a movie to the visual system. Let's say some signal is a function of time. And of course, it could be not just one function of time, but many. And once again, we have the outputs of neurons. Start with one, but we can imagine doing many. And what I'd like to do is to tell you, first of all, I'd like to know how much information the neural response provides about the stimulus. So I'd like to ask how much information the response gives about the stimulus. And I'd like to know, is there a bound or a limit on this against which I can compare so that I can ask whether the system's being efficient or not? So when we talked about estimating motion, we know that there was a bound on how accurately you could do it that came from the noise in the photoreceptors. When I ask you how much information the output of a set of neurons provides about the stimulus, the question is, what's the corresponding bound? Okay, what's the limit to how well you can do? So the first problem, of course, is that we have to take the intuitive notion of providing information and make it mathematically precise. So as I think you all know, this was done by Shannon. These famous papers in 1948. And by the way, it remains true, I believe, that if you want to learn something about information theory, you should read Shannon rather than reading textbooks. He was incredibly clear. And the mathematics is actually quite elementary. So there's no excuse, right? There's no excuse, right? And you read the textbooks and it gets all confused. So what's the problem? Well, Shannon did many things in these papers, actually startlingly many. But the first thing he did was to say, I want to take this intuitive notion of providing information and make it precise. So how do I do it? And what, in your statistical mechanics course, right, they taught you that the entropy of the gas in this room has something to do with, and they usually use those words, something to do with, your uncertainty about the state of all the gas molecules. Another way of saying it is that if I knew exactly where all the gas molecules were, then of course there isn't any entropy left, and how fast they were moving, there isn't any entropy left, right? There's no uncertainty. So the entropy measures, in that sense, the amount of information you could gain if I told you the microscopic state. Right? In the same way that entropy measures your uncertainty about the microscopic state, or the log of the number of possible microscopic states that are consistent with your macroscopic observations, the flip side of that is that if I told you the macroscopic state, then all that uncertainty would be removed, and that's the information you would gain. Now, in your statistical mechanics course, this is presented as a sort of intuitive way of understanding what the entropy is. What Shannon did was to actually prove that if, instead of asking thermodynamics questions, right? I mean, the entropy was a thermodynamic concept before it was a statistical one. What Shannon said was, suppose that I just focus on this notion of conveying information. So he said, to be very explicit, you ask a question, and you have a set of possible answers. 1, 2, out to n, and they have some a priori probabilities. So for instance, if I ask you about the velocities of the gas molecules in this room, a priori you know that they're chosen from the Maxwell distribution, from the Boltzmann distribution, right? But there's a question, if you actually went and measured the velocity of every single molecule, what number would you get? So that's a way of thinking about it. If I told you exactly what the velocities all were, I would specify some particular answer to your question. On the other hand, you know the probability distribution of the answers. It's the Boltzmann distribution. If I ask you, what's the weather going to be like tomorrow? You can obviously imagine the list of possible answers. I mean, the temperature rounded off to 1 degree Celsius in some range, yes or no on the rain, and so on. And furthermore, you can go figure out a priori what it would be by, well, the variety of possibilities. One is you could think about this date in Santa Barbara over the last 50 years, right? That gives you a priori what you expect the weather to be. But then when you actually find out what it is, that will give you a certain amount of information. And so what Shannon asked was, how do I go from this list of possible answers with their a priori probabilities to a single number that measures on average how much information I'll gain when I find out the actual answer? When I find out the actual answer. Okay, is that clear? And what's striking is that he was able to prove that if you have very simple, so I want to go from the set of probabilities to an information gained, the average information gained on hearing the answer. And his argument was very simple. He said, this measure should obey three conditions. One is, if all pi go like 1 over n, then the information should go up with n. So if all answers are equally likely, then the more possible answers, the bigger the amount of information you'll gain when you finally hear it, right? So if the temperature could be uniformly distributed between T1 and T2, then the bigger the difference between T1 and T2, the more information I'm actually giving you when I tell you the right temperature. Makes perfect sense. The other one is, that independent pieces add information. So if I ask you, how tall are you and what's the temperature going to be tomorrow? I should be able to break that into the amount of information I'm going to gain by hearing about the temperature and the amount of information by learning how tall you are. Right? These have nothing to do with each other. Okay? And if you average over the whole world, actually, that's not true. But people's height depend on, never mind. But you know what I mean, right? Completely innocuous hypothesis. If I have, if the question has independent parts, then it ought to be true that I can break it into the part, the information you gain on hearing one part, and the other part, just add them up. And then the third one is kind of a generalization of this, which you can think of as weighted summation. So sometimes a question can be broken, can be thought of as being a tree, right? So the question has many subparts. And you can think about answering the whole question by working your way through the parts. So first you check, I mean, it's like playing 20 questions, right? You know, is the person alive or dead, male or female, right? And you kind of work your way, and the point is that if you hear one answer, you might go in one direction rather than another. And at each of course, if every branch was just a binary branch, then it would be simple. But what you expect is that some of the branches will have, say, 5 leaves, and some of them will have 3 leaves. And you have the idea that when you get to one of these places where there are 3 possibilities, you ought to be able to ask the question, which of the 3 is it? And you gain a certain amount of information there. And you ought to be able to work your way back up the tree and just add the information you gained every time you came to a branch point. Of course, weighted by the probability that you took that branch. Okay? So this is all you need. And it turns out that the only function of the probabilities that satisfies this is the entropy. It's quite striking. It's quite striking. So this is sufficient to prove this. Okay? So this means that there's absolute, all statistical mechanics textbooks written after 1948 have no excuse for being so vague about the connection between between your uncertainty and the entropy, right? It's a theorem. And it's not even that hard to prove. Okay? It's elementary mathematics. Is it clear? Now, of course, this is the situation where you hear the exact answer. Right? And so in this sense, this is measuring the information that's available if you get the exact answer. The more normal situation is that you get an answer which partially restricts the possibilities but does not uniquely specify them. Right? So more generally, what you can say is that information gain is equal to entropy reduction, right? And the same arguments tell you that this has to be true, right? So if, for example, you have some signals in the outside world which are parameterized by 2 numbers, and a priori they can live anywhere in here, then if you think about it, there's a probability distribution of the signals, and this has an entropy which is sort of the log of the area that's taken up by this, right? right? Because the probability is 1 over the area, right? If it's uniform inside this region, then the probability is 1 over the area. And so if you take the sum of minus p log p, you get the log of the area, right? But then let's say you observe the response of some neuron, and the response of some neuron, having seen this particular response, you now know that the signal is in there somewhere. Okay? So you ask, how much information did you gain? The answer is that now I have some probability distribution of the stimulus given a particular response, and it has an entropy which is like the log of area prime, right? So this is the area, this is area prime. And so the information gain that the response provides about S is just the log of area over area prime, right? It's the log of the, this is just like the change in entropy of an ideal gas when you expand it, right? It's the log of the change in, it's the log of the volume ratio. Okay? There's one more bit of formalism that we need, and that is that if I ask you how much information the response of a neuron provides about the stimulus, well, information gain is the law, is the reduction in entropy, right? So I should compute the entropy of the probability distribution of stimuli. That's what I start with. And then after I observe a particular response, I have a different entropy, right? I have a different distribution. I have the conditional distribution of stimuli given that you've seen that particular response, and it presumably has a lower entropy, and so you've gained information. But maybe you don't want to know how much information you gained by seeing this particular response. Maybe you'd prefer to ask, on average, how much information do you gain on seeing a response? So what you should do is to sum over all responses weighted by the probability of the response. Okay? And then this is an average information. So if you work out the formulas, you can convince yourself that this actually has a very simple form. Looks like this. Okay? So just work out the algebra, and that's what you get. Now, the interesting thing about this is you'll notice that it's symmetric in the stimulus and the response. Right? So this is the joint probability distribution of observing both of them, and these are the two marginals. What that means is that the information that the response provides about the stimulus, on average, is the same as the information that the stimulus provides about the response. Okay? Which is why this is sometimes called mutual information. Okay. So this is all we need, so maybe we should make sure it's clear. No. Entropy is only defined up to some additive constant. Yeah, so you'll notice that this is actually very important. entropies of continuous variables depend. Right. So it's the same problem. Right. So the entropy is not defined up to a constant. But you have to choose the same constant, because you have to choose the same units in both cases, and then you get a ratio and it doesn't matter. So it's the same problem with the entropy of the gas in this room in classical physics. Right? Everybody remembers this? Right, if you try to do the entropy of a classical gas, you have a problem. Okay. Well, there are two problems. One has to do with combinatorics, but the other one has to do with units. So, well, but that's the same. But that's the same problem, right? Because if I choose the wrong units, then the entropy will come out to be negative, among other things. Right. Yeah. Yeah. So the point is that the initial discussion presumes the existence of a discrete set of possibilities, and then you sort of naively take the continuum limit, and you're not guaranteed that that limit exists. And for information, it does. In the same way that for entropy changes, right? If you consider if you do the quantum mechanics of the gas in this room, right? Then you get a number for the entropy. Now you let Planck's constant go to zero. The number just keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger, right? This doesn't make any sense because you say, well, what the hell does quantum mechanics have to do with the gas in the room, right? It shouldn't make any difference. Of course, anything you could observe, namely a change in entropy, which is the thing that leads to heat flows, has a finite limit as h bar goes to zero. It's only the entropy that has a problem. Okay. Same issue here. Okay. So. That's a practical problem. It's not a formal problem. So is Misha's concern clear? It's actually, as a practical matter, that is quite serious. Right. So, right. Good. So, everybody okay? So, how do I actually use this? Well, let's go back to this picture I drew here, which now conveniently reappears as I move the boards around. Let me imagine that what I do is I look at a window in my response of size t. Now, how do I describe the response inside that window? Well, let's do something simple. Let's imagine that you have some fixed time resolution. Of course, we don't know what time resolution to pick, so it's a parameter. But let's just imagine that what you do is inside the window you cut with time resolution delta t and just report how many spikes occur in each bin. Okay? So I have some bin size delta t. And so now the response here is 0, 0, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 0, 0, which let me call a word, right? And you'll notice that it has a number of characters, which is capital T divided by delta T. Now, because the information is mutual, in the same way that the information is the entropy of the stimulus minus the entropy of the stimulus given the response averaged over responses, right? That's what we wrote down up there. It's also the entropy of the responses, minus the entropy of the response given the stimulus, averaged over stimuli. Okay, algebra. So how do I find the entropy of the response? Well, responses are these words. So what I do is, I do a long experiment. I show a movie, look through the whole movie, write down every word that occurs, and build up the probability distribution. This is just that, right? Sum over all the words. So that's easy. Harder is this one. What I want to do is to ask you, given that the stimulus was exactly the same, what is the distribution of words? Well, what I could do is to do a long continuous experiment and hope that by accident, at some point, the stimulus was close enough to repeating itself that I could take two things and put them together, right? But the other thing I could do is to take the whole movie that I showed and play it again, right? And when I play it again and I get to exactly this part of the movie, I look again to see what word is produced. Okay? And I do this many times. And so if you show the movie many times, then at this point in the movie, you'll find a distribution of words. And that's the distribution of responses given the stimulus. And what's nice about that is I don't need to tell you what it was about the stimulus that the neuron cared about, right? I don't actually know what it is in here that's causing the spikes to occur. I just know that if I just wrap everything around and play the movie exactly over again, then whatever the stimulus is, it's the same at this time. If I look at a particular time in the stimulus movie and look at the words that are generated there every time I play the movie over and over and over again, I can compute the entropy at that instant in time. But then, of course, I need to average over stimuli, and so I exchange the average over the distribution of stimuli for an average over time, which works if everything is ergodic, right? So I have a distribution from which I'm drawing my stimuli, and if that defines a process which is ergodic, then if I can average long enough, then averaging over time and averaging over the distribution of stimuli become the same thing. By the way, being ergodic doesn't require sampling all possible. I mean, right, that's right, right. What's required is that averages over time approach expectation values in the distribution. And of course, that happens when, if you have processes that have finite correlation times, that happens as long as the time over which you average is long compared to many correlation times, which is, of course, a very short time compared to the time required to visit every point in the space. Sure. So you make a world in your experiment which consists of drawing stimuli from a distribution. And this is not a failing of information theory. This is the way all experiments are done. It's just that when you try to do an information theoretic calculation, you're suddenly aware of this fact that your experiment defines this world in which stimuli are drawn from some distribution. And if you use a dumb distribution, then you won't really understand what the system's doing. So, for example, you might like to try and make the distribution from which you draw these stimuli more and more naturalistic. That, of course, has the problem that natural signals have long correlation times, so it gets harder to be in the ergodic limit. So there are trade-offs. And in every system, there's a long discussion, not terribly enlightening. about the pluses and minuses of different trade-offs. Right. So one of the things that we've tried to do here, actually, can I just, I want to write one more, I want to finish the equation. So the point I wanted to make then is that to do this averaging over stimuli, in the end what you do is just average over time. Okay? So you make use of ergodicity. Now, so the first thing that you notice, the first thing that you notice, yeah. Oh, it depends on the length of the word, and it depends on the time resolution.
Okay, then what's the optimal length?
Okay, hang on for a minute, all right? We'll get to this. So this is an information which, as you say, it depends explicitly. So, as you point out, for most of the work that's been done in sensory neuroscience, stimuli are very simple. So for instance, if you work in the auditory system, you study tones and clicks, or a couple of tones, or some simple stuff like that. Or even if you say, I'm going to study speech, instead of studying speech, you study vowels. And then instead of studying real vowels, you study perfectly periodic signals that have the same, that have approximately the same power spectrum as vowels. Right? I don't know why people do this, but anyhow. Right? Simpler, they say. So here, there's absolutely no reason why you can't just talk, right? If you want to study the encoding of speech, talk. And then we'll get a long recording of speech sounds, and we'll repeat them, and we'll do this, and we'll ask how much information is conveyed about the speech sounds. Now, the problem, of course, is that precisely because it doesn't require you to say which aspects of the stimulus are important, you also do not yet learn which features the system's actually pulling out. But it does, for example, allow you to ask the question of whether, if I replace the speech sounds with something that has the same power spectrum, but none of the other correlations, does the system provide more or less information? Right? So is it picking up on these correlations and so on? So you can ask questions like that. So, okay, so you might be surprised to learn that in the study of neurons that are responsive to visual motion, it was conventional to give motion signals which correspond to constant velocities for periods of seconds, or sinusoidal velocities, or something like this. One can argue about the situation in primates, but if you think about a constant angular velocity for a couple of seconds for a flying creature, that's very strange, right? Corresponds to somehow taking this long turn or something, right? It's very odd. So what you'd like to do is to deliver stimuli that are more like the trajectories that animals actually take. And so, although in the lab we've done things where we just do random, sort of random walk type things, what Rob has been doing lately is looking at the experiments that have been done on the trajectories taken by flying flies, and then, which involves these acrobatic maneuvers, and then taking the fly and mounting him on a motor drive and taking the whole experiment outside into the woods where the fly was actually caught and driving the fly along the angular trajectories that flies are actually observed to go along. So you're recording with natural inputs, right? The scenes outside, which actually for flies not trivial. First of all, the lights are very bright outside, much brighter than you get in laboratory displays. And the field of view then is all the way around the fly. Like flies can see back here, and they actually integrate that information when they estimate motion. So it's sort of important that you drive this part. Right? It's much easier to drive it by taking the animal outside and rotating him than by building an IMAX theater for the fly, right? And of course, you have these enormous velocities during acrobatic flight, which are actually hard to make on a computer monitor. Right? It's much easier to actually just mechanically move him. Although, that's a sort of theoretical statement, right? It's easier to build a motor that rotates at those speeds than it is to actually refresh the screen so that... But of course, remember, you also have to have the electrode inside the animal while you're doing this, and you're spinning him at 2,000 degrees per second, and you have to reverse in 10 milliseconds. So that's quite a feat, actually. It's not even trivial to make sure that you don't end up with all the cables tangled, right? But the hard part's actually keeping the electrode in place, so you should ask Rob how he does it sometime. I have to admit, I'm still not completely certain I understand it, but it works. So there, what you're trying to do then is to say, well, I don't know what the right stimuli are, or what the right distribution stimuli are, but I've seen animals do this, so I'm just going to sample that, right? Say that's what they do in the wild, and then you can go through all of this. Yes.
In this context, I wonder. So, how do you know when whenever they generate the setup, the optimal? So when is that set up? Is that set up earlier or later? Wouldn't that determine also what pictures it sees?
So.
Okay.
So let me get to a semi punchline at this stage, and then we'll get to this question of adaptation and so forth. So it's clear then what you're supposed to do, right? Remember, we also said that we wanted to know whether there's a bound on how much information the system can transmit, and the answer is sort of sitting right here, right? If you think about the entropy of your responses, in some sense, that's the size of the vocabulary that the neuron is using to describe what's going on in the outside world. And clearly, the best it could ever do is to associate each different word with a different stimulus in the outside world. Can't do any better than that. And so the upper bound for how much information you can transmit is set by this entropy. So this is, of course, less than or equal to the entropy of the responses. But actually, you can do even better, right? Because the responses are a collection of action potentials. They occur at some average rate, but they also have some internal statistical structure. If I tell you the average rate, then you know that there's a maximum possible entropy, because you can think of the action potentials as being like the particles of a gas in one dimension. And the rate is the density of the gas, right? It's how many particles you find per unit length. Well, you know that if you have a gas of particles, the entropy can never be bigger than the ideal gas entropy. So there's another bound here, which is the ideal gas bound. So let me tell you what happens. Let's say you do this experiment of going outside and driving the fly along realistic trajectories that flies actually take during acrobatic flight. What you find is that this information let's say we take t is 32 milliseconds or something, right? So we just take a window which we know is relevant to behavior. So of course, delta t, our resolution, can't be any bigger than 32 milliseconds, right? Doesn't make any sense. So at one limit, all we do is we just count the spikes in a 32 millisecond window, and we say that's the response. And then down here somewhere, we actually look with millisecond resolution at exactly where the spikes occur. And so what you find is that as you increase your time resolution down to the millisecond scale, The information that you're capable of, that the spike train represents in a 32 millisecond window is growing by a factor of 3 or 4. And what's striking is that if you measure the efficiency, that is to say, how does the information compare with the entropy, it's almost constant. So what that means is that, and this was pointed out by Mackay and McCulloch in 1952, if you look at the spike train at finer and finer time resolution, you have a greater capacity to carry information. And the question is whether that capacity is used. The capacity is measured by this entropy of the response, right? When you look at finer and finer detail of timing, you're distinguishing more possibilities. So the entropy goes up. In the same way that if you make the value of H bar smaller, the entropy of the gas in the room goes up. The question is that actually being used to convey information? And the answer is that as you push down to millisecond resolution, it's used with almost constant efficiency, and that efficiency is about 50%. In fact, outside, on a nice bright day, you can get 65-70% down to millisecond resolution. And furthermore, it isn't clear that things stop at 1 millisecond. You can find structures in the spike train that are reproducible on the 100 microsecond timescale, which is quite striking. Remember, this is a visual system, not an auditory system. Right? And 100 microseconds is probably the limit of the instrumentation. It's not so easy to sample the probability distributions when delta t is 100 microseconds, because then the words are very, very long. So the conclusion is that under these naturalistic conditions, the system achieves a rather high efficiency down to very fine time resolution. What I haven't told you is that if you try to dissect this information into pieces that come, so one possible reason why the information gets bigger as delta t gets smaller is just that the spikes are pointing to events in the outside world, and they point with very high precision. Another possibility is that they point with reasonable precision, but that there's extra information contained in the patterns of the spikes. So maybe they point to the outside world with 2 or 3 millisecond precision, but the relative timing of the spikes is defined to millisecond, sub-millisecond precision, and that actually tells you something about what's happening. And so you can try and dissect the information into these different pieces, and it turns out that a significant fraction of the information, let's say 30-35% or so, is sitting in these patterns. Okay, it's beyond what you can get by just thinking about single spikes. If you look at many different individual flies, what you find is that almost everything is different. Right? You go to the same neuron, right? Remember, the neurons are named and numbered, but the average firing rate of the cell is different. The total information rate of the cell is different. But what's not different is that they all have approximately constant efficiency. So you look at a population of flies who, when they see the same movie, have firing rates which vary over a factor of 3, yet the efficiencies, that is to say the information versus entropy, is constant to within 10%. And actually, amusingly, if you sort of trace things through, it turns out that a lot of the individuality in the codes is related to the way they use this extra information that's buried in the patterns. So the lesson here is that this is a system in which the capacity of the system to carry information is actually being used efficiently over a wide range of timescales. Somebody asked a question about what the optimal value is for the window size. And what you might hope is that if you make the window size big enough, eventually what you get is just the information accumulates at a constant rate. So in a sense, it's not terribly important then exactly what window size you pick. There's some questions as to whether you have enough data to see that limiting behavior or not. Okay, that's a technicality. So there really isn't an optimal size for this.
Right,
the rate should saturate. Not the information. Because remember, the signal is continuously varying. So at some point, you just start gaining information at a constant rate. Okay. So in some sense, the most basic prediction of this idea of efficient representation is correct here. Okay? The information really is represented efficiently. And people have tried to do, people have done similar things in other systems, but it'd take a long time to sort of go through all the details. The crucial thing, I think, about this hypothesis of efficient representation is that the structure of an efficient representation requires some matching between your coding strategy and the statistics of the input signals. So after the break, we'll come back and I'll tell you very briefly what it is we know about this matching. And in particular, what I'll try and convince you of is that the system achieves this efficiency precisely through an adaptive strategy that matches the coding to the distribution of inputs, okay? Which we can do just by changing the distribution of inputs, okay? And then we'll try and see whether there are some more general lessons out of all of this. So, yeah, it's 10 or 15 minutes or so, maybe a few minutes before 4. So what I'd like to do now is to take a few minutes and tell you about the problems of adaptation in this system. You remember at the very beginning I told you that there were three problems at least that this system would illustrate for us. One was the problems of signal to noise, which we talked about before lunch. One was problems about the structure and efficiency of the code, of which I've told you some set of things here. And the last was the problem of dynamic range. So one way of phrasing this problem is to ask how it's possible that we got the results that we did. So I told you that we get these very high efficiencies, sometimes 65-70%. Now, those highest efficiencies are obtained under conditions which are reasonably naturalistic. But in fact, there were laboratory experiments before this with stimuli that were very dynamic, but not particularly natural. And those had efficiencies of 50-55%. So there's two possibilities. One is that those laboratory stimuli were chosen from probability distributions that were very carefully crafted to help enhance the efficiency, so that when we tell you about the results, they come out sounding nice, right? So, I mean, in some sense, we could be lying to you. There's lots of different stimuli that we chose that didn't work, right? And in fact, actually more serious, you could be lying to yourself, that you know so much about how the system works that you, of course, choose things that the system likes and gives nice, healthy responses to. But the more interesting possibility is that the reason that you get very high efficiencies when you just go in the lab and do an experiment is because the system is adapting to the distribution of stimuli that you used and changing its coding strategy so that within reasonable limits, it can achieve a high efficiency and a high precision of actually estimating velocity without sort of your having to have picked exactly the right thing. And so I'd like to argue that, in fact, that's what's happening. And this is, in some ways, I was being very critical before of the idea that the way to test the hypothesis of efficient coding was to go through this procedure of making models and predicting receptive fields and all this stuff. And I mean, it's a very nice and useful to go through those calculations. It's an interesting exercise. But as a way of testing the hypothesis, it's sort of indirect. So you could be exactly right about your optimization principle and completely wrong about what the neurons are capable of doing, and then you'll get the wrong answer, right? Whereas what we're doing here is we're saying, look, we can directly measure the information. We can directly measure the efficiency, and the most profound and obvious prediction of the hypothesis of efficient coding is that the coding strategy should be matched to the distribution of inputs. So why don't we just look directly for that? If we change the distribution of inputs, does the structure of the code change? Okay, so how do we do it? Well, it's in principle straightforward. So let's do something very easy. Let's do something that corresponds to this business of a fly flying along relatively straight so that the typical velocities are relatively small. And then all of a sudden he starts doing acrobatics and the typical velocities get to be very large. So that means you're seeing a signal. Looks like this. And then all of a sudden, you have something that looks like this, right? So the question is, how does the system deal with this transition? So what we'd like to do is to ask, how are stimuli mapped into responses? What's the form of that mapping? And let's actually do the simplest possible thing. Right, so one possibility, so is it clear to everybody that if this relationship is fixed, it's going to be very hard to be efficient under both of these conditions, right? Because if this range of stimuli was causing you to wander around and use up your vocabulary, right, so that these small differences in here get mapped to different words, then what are you going to do when you deal with stimuli like this, right? You have to, right? You have to make up new words, right? Or else you have to remap them. So to first, let me tell you that the first approximation, it's not exact, but the first approximation, when you come to steady state, the set of words that are being used, the set of patterns of action potentials, is not that different. So the average firing rate is different, but not that different. And the higher order statistics and so on is not that different. Right, so so you want to so you have to arrange it so that, so what you have to do is to arrange it so that the higher amplitudes, so let's suppose you had approximately the same number. I guess what you could do is, in the small amplitude case, it could be that let's say the relative timing of spikes is insignificant. And then as the stimuli get larger, you start to use that to code the amplitude or something. But this then requires some elaboration, right? So maybe the statement that any fixed rule is going to have a hard time being efficient in both cases is a little too strong. But certainly any simple fixed rules are going to have trouble. So let me actually strip everything down and just ask about the probability of making a spike. So not the whole mapping into words and everything else, but just do the probability of making a spike. So what I'd like to know is, in these two different worlds that we can sample, how does the probability of making a spike depend on the stimulus? So I'm sitting here, and I see a spike, or there might be a spike, right? And I look back at this stimulus, and I know that whatever is happening here maps to the probability of putting a spike there. And similarly here, I look back, and this maps to the probability of making a spike. So what's the structure of that mapping? Well, this is a hard problem, right? Because maybe this is 200 milliseconds long. And we know that the spikes are precise down to, let's say, 2 milliseconds. So that means that you kind of have to align everything to 2 millisecond precision with 200 millisecond windows, which means that in here, the stimulus is actually 100 numbers. Right? So that's a big space, right? So I'm asking you for the mapping from a 100-dimensional space to the probability of making a spike. That's a kind of hopeless problem, right? So it had better be that somehow not all 100 dimensions are relevant of it. Otherwise, we're never going to relevant. Otherwise, we're never going to get anywhere. So let me tell you that, of course, that's true. Not all 100 dimensions are relevant. And there's a variety of ways of convincing yourself of this. So there's a paper by our postdoc, Nama Brenner, which came out in Neuron last year. Also by me and by Rob. In which is what I'm going to tell you about right now. And one of the things we do in there is to show how to do this dimensionality reduction. So let me just say in words what the idea is, because we don't have time for the details, and it's really sort of off the point. It's kind of interesting, but it's off the point. Suppose that I look every time a spike occurs, and I look back at what the stimulus was. Now, if the cell, there's 100 different directions in the space of stimuli. What I can do is to measure the variance of the stimuli along any direction in that space. Now, if the cell, in some sense, doesn't care about this direction, then whether I trigger on a spike or trigger on a random time, I'm going to find the same variance, because the cell doesn't care, right? It doesn't push the probability distribution around in any way. So what I should do is, every time I see a spike, I should look at the variance. In fact, I want to look at the covariance matrix in this 100-dimensional space, and then ask, how many directions are there in that 100-dimensional space where the variance is different when you trigger on a spike versus triggering on a random time? And that turns out to be a small number of directions. Okay. In fact, for the conditions of the experiments that were done in this work, there are two directions, and they correspond to something perfectly sensible. This is a motion-sensitive neuron, so one possibility is that you're sensitive to something like velocity averaged over some small window. And the next natural possibility is you're sensitive to acceleration. And everybody knows this, and so it's not a terribly big surprise. What's neat is that that actually captures 95% of the information, so you know that it's really right in this case. So the only trick then is to figure out how do you compute the windows over which you average, and that's a technicality. Yeah? Sure. So if I pick a random time, and I look in this 100-dimensional space, I can't sample the whole probability distribution, right? But I can compute the covariance matrix. So the covariance matrix gives me this sort of ellipsoid, right, that tells me some directions have big variance, some directions have small variance.
But now we are dealing with the signal itself or with the word?
We're dealing with the signal itself. Okay. So we look at the signal itself, we look at its covariance matrix, and it's this 100-dimensional football, right? Now I go through and I look only at the times where a spike occurred, and I do the same thing. And I look at this football again, and it's been deformed along some number of directions. So I count how many directions it was deformed along, and say those are the directions the cell cares about. And the answer is there are two. And the answer is there are two. Okay. Now, in principle, this idea of dimensionality reduction could have been qualitatively right, but it need not have been this simple. So the fact that it was this simple is probably a little bit of luck. Okay, but now what that says is that I look back and I have some window here that I use for smoothing everything out. And that gives me one component of the stimulus, which is a sort of velocity. And then I also have another little template, right? And so I project the stimulus to a filter that looks like this, and this gives me another component, which is like an acceleration. Okay. Simple. Now, what I want to know is, if I'm in some place in this space of velocity and acceleration, what's the probability that I make a spike? So I'd like to know the probability of a spike given S1 and S2. And so the way to find this out is to use Bayes' rule again. By the way, the probability of spike given the stimulus has a conventional name. It's called the firing rate, right? So what we're doing is we're sort of backing our way into talking about how does the firing rate depend on on where I am in stimulus space. So the way I figure it out is every time I see a spike, I go back and look to see what the stimulus was. And I make a histogram. And then I normalize that histogram by the a priori probability of the stimuli. And that tells me what the input-output relation is. Okay? So it's simple. You figure out what these dimensions are, then you run through the whole experiment, make the histograms, normalize, and you get the input-output relation. So for example, suppose you look just along the dimension S1. Well, it's a motion-sensitive neuron. It's direction-sensitive, so if the velocity is in some units positive, you presumably get a higher probability of making a spike. If it's negative, you get a lower probability of making a spike. If you make the velocity sufficiently negative, the probability should go to zero. You get this, right? Not surprising. But that was when we did the experiment under one set of conditions. And you might ask yourself, under these sets of conditions, what is it? How does the axis here, which tells you the typical scale of the stimuli, compared to the axis over here. And what's striking is that one standard deviation in the stimulus is about like this. So it would appear, either by luck or by something else, that we chose the distribution of stimuli so that it's just broad enough to sweep the neuron from relatively low probability of spiking to high probability of spiking. So now what's going to happen if we go to this stimulus, which of course is an order of magnitude larger, so it looks like this, then basically the thing will spend all of its time either at high probability or low probability, right? Of course not, right? But that wouldn't work, right? Because then it wouldn't actually be able to code anything about the variations of the stimulus. So what happens, amazingly enough, is that the probability of making a spike becomes a different function of the stimulus. So this is A, B.
Do you average again over the same time interval?
The same.
S1 is something like an average below 200
milliseconds. It's over a little 40 millisecond window inside the 200 milliseconds. So you can either hold this fixed, or you could redetermine what the correct thing is in this new ensemble. And there's so slight for this set of experiments. There's a slight difference, which is interesting, but that's not the essence of what's going on. Yeah, we're in steady state. Hang on. Let me tell you what happens, and I'll tell you how long it takes. That's not a trivial question. So, so if you're a physicist of a certain age, you can be very amused by the following thing. So you do this under many different conditions, and you see this behavior. And I told you that approximately in condition A, you know, one standard deviation was about like this. So somehow the features of the curve are on the scale of a standard deviation. So what we decided to do was, first of all, to plot the log of the probability of a spike. given S1. Because actually, there are tens of thousands of spikes in the experiment. And so that means that we're hiding something from you when you show you the curve like this, because actually we can follow this down several orders of magnitude. So actually it looks like this, right? So you can see more of this stuff. And actually it's, I mean, it is kind of impressive that you can do like that with small, with reasonable error bars. And of course, if we plotted the same thing, again, we'd get this thing tilted over. But what we did instead is to ask what happens if you plot things normalized with respect to the standard deviation. And then what you find is the data lay on top of each other. Right? So if this is A and that's B. Okay. So what the system has done is to encode the signal in normalized units. Right? So the probability of making a spike doesn't depend on the stimulus. It depends on the stimulus in units of its standard deviation. It's quite striking. There are small deviations from this scaling behavior, which might be interesting. But this is the sort of zero-order picture. Now, what good is this? Well, we had this intuition that if the thing didn't do something like this, it would be very hard to encode these signals of different dynamic range. So what you can think about is that we've observed the system to have this input-output relation, or this input-output relation, or whatever. This input-output relation, right? Under different conditions, we've seen all of these. Oh, because it's adaptation to a statistical parameter. It's adaptation to the variance. Right. It would seem, yeah. Right. Whether you want to call it learning, of course, that's right. Of course, the mean is also a statistical parameter, right? It's just a simple one.
Yeah, but let's say that.
Yes, so of course you understand that that's not what, so, right. When you start talking about random variations of luminance, then it becomes comparable to this. And there is an adaptation to contrast, which was in fact, I mean, there's an adaptation to contrast which is of this form, which is different than the usual contrast adaptation. So the point is that if you imagine that the stimuli now have some probability distribution, the question is, which of these input-output relations is the system going to choose to attach to this probability distribution? And so the answer is that we can calculate how much information the system would convey if it used each of these different input-output relations for this distribution. In fact, to do that requires some assumptions about the properties of noise. But in fact, you can measure them, right? If you do a little more work, you can also measure the statistics of the noise in these systems as well. And it also has some simple scaling behavior. So what we can actually do is a model-independent calculation of, as the system sweeps through its range of input-output relations, how does the information that would be encoded vary? And the answer is that if you think of this axis as being a sort of scaling, you know, this is a sort of stretching of the input-output relation, then the information as a function of lambda peaks at well, we'll call it lambda equals 1, which is the one that's observed experimentally. Okay. So one way of saying it is as I change from here to here, the information that you'd get about a signal that looks like this changes and peaks at some point. And then you go and ask, which input-output relation does the neuron actually use when you give this distribution? And the answer is it's this one, with very small errors. So what you have is a direct demonstration that the system is adapting, changing its input-output relation. In fact, in a very simple way, which, as I say, kind of warms your heart if you grew up looking at scaling behavior, but maybe that's not even so important, right? We observe that the system has a one-parameter family of input-output relations. And if you ask yourself, which parameter should it pick? The answer is, it picks the one that maximizes information transmission. Okay? So it's a sort of direct demonstration of what you're hoping to see. Now, how long does it take to do it? It's an adaptation to a variance. If you're watching a signal change, how do you know whether the variance went up? You have to accumulate statistics. That takes time. In fact, it's not a trivial question how long it takes, because if this signal has a very high bandwidth, then it doesn't take so long. But of course, if the signal has a very high bandwidth, then you expect that the high frequency components will get lost in the noise in the system. So what really determines how rapidly you can accumulate samples is something about the noise in the initial representation of the data. So we have to go all the way back to the discussion of noise in estimating velocities given the noise in the photoreceptors to figure out what is actually the time scale on which the shortest possible time scale on which you can see a change in the variance reliably. It of course also depends on how big a change in variance you make. Obviously, if I make a very small change in variance, it could take you a long time to be sure. But if I make a reasonably healthy change in variance, then it's essentially a time scale which is determined by how long it takes to get one clean, independent sample, right? So one sample that's reliable in the sense that you've suppressed all the noise and is independent of the previous sample. And so that time scale is surprisingly short. It's something like 40 milliseconds or so under the conditions of the experiments that we did. And so there's actually a really incredible effort by another postdoc in the group, Adrienne Fairhall, to see if she can directly measure this timescale. So the first attempt was to just try and measure the input-output relation at different times. Well, actually, the first thing you do is just try to measure the average firing rate. And you discover that the average firing rate, when you make a switch like this, jumps up and then slowly decays. And in fact, if you switch every 2 seconds, you see that the decay takes about a second. And if you switch every 10 seconds, you see that the decay takes about 5 seconds. And if you switch, well, you know what happens, right? So actually, what's happening, of course, is that the decay is not exponential, and in fact has a power law tail. Let's average. Right, that's a separate question, right? So let's just do the simple thing of switching back and forth at some rate, many times an average, a sort of standard physiology experiment, right? And then you see a decay, except the problem is the decay depends on how often you switch, which of course suggests either that the basic decay is not exponential or that the system also learns how often you're switching. And we haven't completely excluded the possibility that it learns how often you're switching, which we would very much like, but we also haven't completely shown that it's true yet. So we're sort of struggling with that one. But it turns out that the firing rate, the changes in firing rate, although they look impressive, are actually almost decoupled from this. Right? Because in some sense, you could also scale this thing up and down, and that gives you a change in firing rate. But this rescaling of the inputs, which is what really allows you to adapt the dynamic range of the system, that happens very fast. And so you're not actually able to collect enough data in a small... So for example, if you cut this thing into 250 millisecond windows, then by the time of the first window, the thing's already snapped from looking like this to looking like that. So what Adrian decided to do, which was really brave, because it's hard to design the experiment to get enough data that you have a chance of seeing anything. Well, she decided to really take this observation very seriously. That if it's really true that the function of this adaptation is to optimize information transmission, then if I could look on very fine timescales, and remember, the words that we look at when we analyze information transmission are short, right? So I can look at the words that occur here and 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 go through and estimate how much information is being transmitted locally. Right? And maybe I'll be able to see that when I make a switch like this, at first the system is inefficient, right? It's got the wrong coding strategy, so it can't transmit as much information, or at least can't transmit it as efficiently. And so you'll see a drop in the efficiency or in the information transmission, and then it'll recover, and that'll allow me to measure this timescale. Okay? So the first thing you should know is a basic statistical fact, which is discriminating an increase in variance and a decrease in variance are asymmetric. If the variance goes up and you see one data point, which is big, you know that the variance went up, right? That's all it takes, because you can't get a big number from a distribution with a small variance. On the other hand, when the variance goes down, it's harder, because even a distribution with a large variance produces a lot of small numbers. So in this direction, if you try and do it, you can't see anything. And in fact, it was known that the relaxation of the rates and everything is also asymmetric. But that's probably a different effect. So if you try and do it this way, you can't see the information change. It's noisy, right? We just can't see it above the noise. So you do it the other way, where you switch down in variance. And then you see a little 70 or 80 millisecond wide hole in the information transmission. And then it jumps back up to its maximum value. And so what that means is that this adjustment in coding strategy is happening on a timescale of perhaps 80 milliseconds. And that is sufficient to readjust the coding strategy enough that you get the information rate back up to where it was before, despite the fact that you went from something that looks like this to something that looks like that. And that timescale is within a factor of 2 of the fastest possible time that you could have, given that you have to accumulate statistics. So what I hope to have told you through all of this is that we have a system in which the rate at which information is transmitted is very high. It can be well over 2 bits per spike. The efficiency of information transmission is high and remains high when you look at time resolutions down to millisecond and below. If you look carefully, that result is universal to all the flies that you look at, despite variations in the structure of the code, which can be quite large. The efficiency has a significant contribution from the patterns of spikes, which is something I didn't talk about. The efficiency is the result, or the high information transmission rate is the result of an adaptation to the statistical structure of your inputs. And at least within a certain range of distributions of inputs, a sort of simple family of distributions, the choice of how the system matches its input-output relation to the distribution of inputs serves exactly to maximize information transmission. And then finally, the speed at which the adjustment is made is close to the limit that's imposed by the need to gather statistics when you're trying to learn what the variance is. So I think that this gives a lot of support to the idea that an information theoretic notion of efficiency really is relevant to how the nervous system works, at least in this case. And you can start to ask, well, you know, what are the analogies in other systems? And that, I mean, that's a long, complicated story. Yes? Well, it's responsible for generating an estimate of visual motion, which eventually provides input to motor control. It's not a direct output neuron. Right.
Somehow, the motor control system should behave completely different under the two different regimes. So somehow the fact that you switch regimes has somehow...
Right, so the problem is, if I encode everything in normalized units, how do I ever really know how fast I'm going? So there are three possible answers. So by the way, this is a general feature of any adaptive strategy, right? Adaptation is a good thing because it allows you to make better use of your dynamic range, blah, 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 blah. But it's a bad thing because it generates ambiguity. The same stimulus, or rather different stimuli, give rise to the same response in the two situations. Very different stimuli, in fact. So there's three possible answers. One is, maybe you don't know. So for instance, our visual system adapts to average light intensity. So how do you ever know how bright the lights are? The answer is you're not very good at judging absolutely how bright the lights are. Okay? It's true. Now, why is that? In other words, presumably what that means is that there isn't much cost to you in evolutionary sense of not knowing the absolute light intensity, and we can argue about why that might be true. But in any case, phenomenologically, the answer is you adapt to that and you don't know the value. Another possibility, is our three? Anyhow, there's, I guess there are four. Another possibility is that this information is carried by some other neurons. So you adapt it away, but there's some other neuron that's actually keeping track of it. So for example, when people started recording from populations of neurons in the retina, many of them at the same time, on the order of once, so you take a slab of the retina, drop it down on an array of electrodes and record from 75 neurons at the same time. Every second experiment, you'd find one neuron that seemed to code for absolute light intensity and nothing else. Okay? So it could be just, I mean, you don't need many, right? Because it's an average, so it doesn't change very often. Another possibility is that it gets compensated for somewhere else. And this, of course, is a very real possibility in this system because I don't need to know how fast I'm turning in degrees per second. What I need to know is what signal to send to my flight muscles. And in fact, in order to know, even if I had a perfect number for degrees per second, the question of what number to send to my flight muscles is not trivial, because I need to know my aerodynamics. And I have to learn my own aerodynamics. So there was once the idea that insects, and in particular insect flight control, was a great example of hard wiring. This can't be right. And it can't be right, not because of biology, but because of physics. Well, there's a little bit of biology. You have to know that insects can change their aerodynamics significantly by eating lunch. But more importantly, their aerodynamics is determined by their wings. And insects, like flies, undergo metamorphosis, right? They start out as maggots. So in fact, the shape of their wings is determined by the air conditions when they dried. And so they can't possibly genetically encode their aerodynamics. It can't be done, right? So they have to learn their aerodynamics. And in fact, you can do experiments to show that they do. Okay? So you could say that since they have to learn their aerodynamics, they could also learn to deal with this issue of scale in the incoming signals. And finally, the last possibility is that if you look carefully at this neuron, then this adaptation to the variance is the zero order picture, but if you look carefully at the statistics of spikes on longer timescales, you might be able to find something that encodes the variance, and that turns out to be true. Whether that's what the animal uses or not, I don't know, but that is true. So if you look carefully at the statistics of the spikes, you can actually estimate the variance. So these small extra things that I kept telling you are not so important for this picture, but they're just enough that you don't completely lose knowledge of what the variance was. Okay. So there are one set of questions, obviously, I mean, there's a lot of questions that come up from all this. Some of a sort of experimental nature, you just like to know what the story is in other systems. There are mechanistic questions. So how does this actually work? Right? How does this kind of adaptation work? And there are very beautiful experiments that Frederiki's been doing where he looks at retinal ganglion cells, and instead of stimulating them with images with various dynamics, he just injects current into them. And he can show that, that some of these phenomena are detectable in a neuron sitting in a dish where you're injecting current. So on this axis, you have the current. And on this axis, you have the probability of making a spike. And you get this adaptation to the variance of the currents that you put in. And you can even trace it down to figure out which channels are involved and so on. So it's very likely that these kinds of phenomena are in fact quite general to neurons, which would be a good thing, because this problem of dealing with differences in dynamic range comes up everywhere, right? I mean, I told you about this, I motivated this problem with the fly flying straight and then starting to do acrobatics. But almost all naturalistic signals have this sort of intermittent structure. So you're going to find the problem everywhere. It would be very attractive if there was a microscopic solution that could also be put everywhere. But again, the details aren't in yet. We started by talking about a measure of, you know, sort of trying to think about optimization. We started with optics, relatively simple. We talked about how you choose your pigments. And then we took this more complicated example of estimating motion. And now we look at a problem of coding. There are other examples that you can pick where there's some notion of optimization. But I think that in fairness, there's a problem, which is that the examples where we have clean results have a tendency to be, in some sense, low-level examples. But what we're talking about here is the coding of a time-varying signal in a single neuron. It really is all about what happens on a 100-millisecond timescale. It's not, in some sense, about anything terribly sophisticated. It's clever, right? There's a lot of interesting stuff going on, and it suggests that there are principles that stand behind what's going on, but it's not about our perception or our cognition or ability to learn and things like this. So, since we started out by talking about optics in the insect eye and these beautiful experiments that Barlow did, I should end by telling you about a very simple thing that Barlow suggested, which remains a great idea for which I think we now have a better theoretical framework, but the experiments are still missing. So he spent a lot of time looking at this issue of optimization and efficiency. He not only had these ideas about efficient representation, he also clarified tremendously these issues about photon counting in the visual system. He did experiments on perception of symmetry in correlated patterns, right? So you make patterns that have a statistical tendency toward being symmetric, and you ask whether you can tell the difference between that and something which is sort of accidentally symmetric. And showed that, in fact, your ability to make that discrimination was close to the limits that are imposed by the statistics in the signal. He's done a variety of these things. And he was worried about sort of where it leads. And so he had a very interesting idea, which was that we should really look at the efficiency of learning. Because you see, what all of these problems have in common is that they're problems of statistical efficiency. Your ability to discriminate signal and noise is, of course, ultimately a statistical question. Your ability to encode a signal is really a question about statistics. How well can you match to the distribution of inputs? As Misha pointed out, in some sense, this is a baby learning problem in which the system has to learn or adapt to the variance of the inputs. And so what we did when we looked at this question of how long it takes, we're really measuring the efficiency with which the system can use its samples to make the inference that the variance has changed. Well, in general, when you try to infer a rule that underlies some body of data, that's again a statistical problem. And there's a question of whether you're being efficient at using the data to infer the rule. And so what Barlow suggested was that we should go out and try and measure the efficiency of learning in the same way that you measure the efficiency of coding or the efficiency of detection or efficiency of estimation and so on. And actually, you know, the first question is, well, what's the limit, right? Well, again, there are statistical and information theoretic limits to how much you can learn. So let me just give you an example. Suppose that, and we'll stop at 5. Suppose that you have a model of the world that says that what's happening is points are being drawn at random from some underlying probability distribution, Q of X. Okay? And let's just assume they're drawn independently. This is the simplest case, right? And so basically what's happening is you have some set of parameters alpha. Which is your model of what's going on in the world. And now as you observe the more and more examples, you sort of try to hone in on what the correct model is. And so you know what happens as long as everything's well behaved. Okay? What happens is you start out that the alphas live in some big parameter space. But after you've seen n examples, where n is a reasonably large number, you sort of know each parameter to an accuracy of about 1 over square root of n, right? It's a data fitting problem. So as you try to learn the model, what happens is that your accuracy gets better and better on each of these parameters. And so you start out in this big parameter space, like this, and after a while, you're in a box whose dimensions are 1 over square root of n, approximately. Well, remember the problem we did where we asked how much information do you gain by seeing the response? And we said, well, it's the log of the ratio of volumes. So if this is true, if this picture is correct, which is the sort of standard picture for fitting parameters to data, then if I ask you how much information have you gained about the parameters, right, your examples have given you information about the parameters, and it's the log of the volume that you started with divided by the volume that you ended with. But the volume that you ended with is 1 over square root of n raised to the power of the number of parameters, right? It's the volume in this space. So it's k over 2 log n. And, of course, you can do this more rigorously than I've done it. By the way, this is not only the amount of information you have about the parameters, it's the amount of information that you have about everything that you're going to see in the future in this time series. Because remember, the points are being chosen independently. So there's nothing predictable about the points. The only thing that's predictable is what distribution they're being drawn from. So in fact, this information is the information that you have for generalizing from what you've seen. At best. So what you'd like to do is to ask, by the way, it has a very interesting feature, which is that the amount of information you have with which to generalize depends on how complex the model is, right? Because the number of parameters actually appears there. It's kind of an interesting connection between the information that you have available for making predictions or generalization and the complexity of the underlying dynamics. And that connection is actually very interesting by itself. And if you want to read about this, there's a paper by myself, my former student Ilya Nemenman, and Polly Tishby. And you can look on the Los Alamos archives. But what's important about this is it tells you that there really is a limit to how much information you have, right? So you could ask then, when you look at how an animal performs in a situation where it has to learn a probability distribution, does it actually gather this much information or not when it's seen n examples? And so the first thing where I want to end is to remind you that there are situations in which animals learn probability distributions, okay, quite explicitly. So you could do this experiment, although it hasn't been done. A simple one, where the probability distribution consists of one number, a probability, is if I ask you to stare ahead, and then when a light comes on to the right or the left, make a saccade in that direction. If you do that, then there's some distribution of times it takes you to saccade. Right? There's a reaction time distribution. If I change the relative probabilities of going right and left, then the whole probability distribution, you learn that, and the whole probability distribution changes as if what was happening is that you're in order to make the decision to saccade, you're integrating a noisy signal until it reaches the threshold. And the threshold has a term in it which is related to log probability, just like it should. Okay? So that's a simple case where you learn a probability. But there's a much more interesting case. It's sort of spectacular. The classic example, or one of the classic examples of Pavlovian conditioning, is the rabbit and the air puff, right? So you have a rabbit with its eye sitting here, right? Its nose, big ears, and you have a puff of air. And you have a tone. So you all know how Pavlovian conditioning works, right? The original idea was you ring the bell and then you feed the animal, and of course after a while he starts salivating whenever you ring the bell. Of course, in order to do this, Pavlov had to figure out a way to look inside to see whether you're salivating, which is kind of a disgusting experiment. This is much easier. What are we going to do here? If I puff air at your eyes and you don't have your glasses on, what do? You blink, right? So if I play a tone 100 milliseconds before I puff the air consistently, after a while you'll blink when I play the tone, and so does the rabbit. And so this is classical stuff, right? So you might think, you know, what the hell does this have to do with anything? And that's actually what I thought. I assumed that this was an incredibly dumb reflex, right? So who cares? Yeah, it's conditioned, but I mean, what's the big deal? So it actually gets more interesting than this, because the classical experiment is done where there's a deterministic relationship between the tone and the puff. So much more interesting is if the relationship is probabilistic. So suppose that when I play the tone, then sometimes the puff goes here, and sometimes it goes here, sometimes it's here, and so on. So there's a probability for the puff to occur. Now, what does the rabbit do? Well, one idea is that he's really worried about getting the puff in his eye, and he closes his eyes here and keeps them closed. Well, that's not a very good idea. These animals are prey, right? It's not a good idea to stand around with your eyes closed if there are things that hunt you. So what I didn't realize when I first read about these experiments, they tell you about it in classes, right? It's a legend, these stupid rabbits. I always thought that blinking was an all or none phenomenon. And I think it is in us, although I'm now sort of curious. I don't know whether you half blink or not. But rabbits very definitely half blink. And they 3/4 blink, and they 20% blink, and so on. So what the rabbit does in this situation is he hedges his bets. And so if you actually monitor the position of his eyelid, he does that. And you can see, apparently, they tell me, if you put bumps and wiggles into the distribution of when you put the puff, you can find bumps and wiggles in where his eyelid is. Now, this clearly represents learning a probability distribution in a very simple way. It's also true that when you walk through the world, you're learning things about the probability distributions of signals, but it's very hard to get you to spit out explicitly your knowledge of that probability distribution. I mean, everything varies, right? You get some things with small numbers of trials. Let me put it this way. I don't believe they did this with the idea of measuring explicitly how well they were learning a probability distribution. It's just that by the time you get through reading the experiments, you realize this is what happened. Okay? So this is an example where, quite strikingly, on a single trial, the way he moves his eyelid encodes, to some extent, his knowledge of the underlying probability distribution. So it's a quite striking example where you can imagine conditioning the animal with different distributions and just being able to read out on a trial-by-trial basis what his knowledge of the underlying distribution is. Okay? So it's a simple case. And so what I think needs to be done is in things like this, as I say, there are other examples where you surely learn a probability distribution, but it's hard to get you to make explicit your knowledge of the distribution. It's possible, actually, that there are certain phenomena in anticipation in eye movements that would be similar in humans, but it's just not, the experiments haven't been done. So this would be an example where, by trying to sort of scale up the sorts of information theoretic analyses that we did in the case of neurons, to looking at sort of the information that sort of eyelid trajectories carry about the underlying probability distribution, you might actually be able to measure the efficiency of learning, which I think would be really interesting, because it would sort of close this set of, I mean, it doesn't close in the sense there are lots of open questions, but it would take this set of notions about efficiency and optimization up to a substantially higher level in our thinking about how the nervous system works. So, as it's turned out, this has been a very phenomenological day. And partly that's because I wanted to try and convince you that by stepping back and studying somewhat simpler systems, one can do experiments that are a little more like the experiments that we grew up with in physics labs. Of course, the compromise is that there are lots of theoretical questions that didn't get talked about. So for instance, it would be great fun to discuss these issues of the complexity of models and its relation to generalization power and so on. But maybe in the pedagogical context, it was better that you see that by going to a simpler system, you can actually make progress on several of these questions that I think are questions of general interest. And as I say, the evidence from a relatively simple system is very much in support of this notion that the nervous system is efficient in an information theoretic or statistical sense, and that it's actually possible for these systems to come very close to the limits that are imposed by the physics of their inputs, which again, I think is quite a sort of surprising and striking thing. So I hope it's been useful and that you see where some of the open problems are. And also see that I mean, it's not completely a black box. One can actually get somewhere. So thanks for your patience. Everything is no doubt completely clear, right? So one way of thinking about this is that it's just an adjustment in gain, right? So if I think, for example, of the signal as being an injected current, if I could, I can either think of it as a change in gain or a change in threshold, right? So what Fred tells me, I haven't seen all of the data, is that in these experiments where you inject current into the neuron, you see this adaptation, and essentially what's happening is that the voltage excursions, which are driven by the currents, as they get larger, tend to inactivate more sodium channels. And the inactivation is long-lived. So essentially what happens is that the membrane becomes less excitable the greater the variance in the currents that you inject, which means that you then have to inject more current to get the same probability of spiking. So that kind of mechanism certainly will work. Whether it'll give you exactly the rescaling behavior, that I don't know. And again, I don't know that that's actually the essential point. This sort of very simple form makes it nice to tell what happened, right? But I don't know that it's complete, that's completely essential. So actually, okay, so that's the answer about microscopics. We could ask about the details of the scaling, but. Yeah, so I guess the question is the word just, right? I mean, okay. It means that the neurons are capable of, I mean, so for instance, if you don't, I think that some of this is probably single neuron, yeah.
By a physical.
Yeah, it's not a network effect. I mean, if you don't do this at a single neuron level, then you have to deal with it at a network level. By the way, one of the reasons for thinking that is that if you think about it, suppose I have lots of little signals that are spread out all over the place, and I have a neuron that brings them together. Now, what I'd like to do is to have them be normalized so that the variance here is in the right range, right? The problem is that I bring the signals together and they're correlated with each other, but I don't know how big the correlations are. So the input neurons can't normalize the signal by themselves. I have to be involved because I'm the only one who knows what happens when I add them all up. Now, it could be that it happens at the synapses because the synapses know something about the correlation of input one with the output, right? Which implicitly has to do with its correlation with all the others. But the simplest thing would be if I add up all the signals, look how big they are, and change my gain in proportion.
I think I understood now why I said just, because if it's really the property that by physics changes into very high fluctuations of the current, then it seems to me that the fact that it's also happened to be optimal in the formation theoretic way is sort of a coincidence.
Well, that's a very interesting question. But in the conventional view, the biophysics doesn't know anything, right? It doesn't know what the network. A network is trying to compute. It doesn't. Network is trying to compute. It doesn't. Nothing knows anything, right? So, I mean, as you know, the particular set of ion channels that you make and that you express and the states of phosphorylation and all this other stuff is all being regulated constantly, and nobody knows what the control signals are. Right? So it's not like the biophysical parameters of a neuron are just set once and for all. Right? So I think the question of how you link, I mean, look, in the level of neural network models, you have the idea that the link between overall functionality and the parameters of the network is through some sort of Hebbian learning, right? Some sort of learning algorithm. But the thing is, it's simply a fact that the intrinsic parameters of neurons are also being regulated. So the question is, how is that linked to functionality? And that's completely open.
When you focus on my gain control, do you see either a mechanism for information on the setting of the gain being propagated outside the cell, starting at a single cell?
Right. So what we find in this case, where again we don't know how much of it is actually single cell and how much of it is network, is that this adaptation is the zero order picture. And if you look carefully at the statistical structure of the spike train on longer times, there's some information left about what the variance is. Okay, which is a little bit hidden from you here. I mean, just because you're looking at one spike, right? It's hard to tell, right? So in that sense, you have this very attractive possibility that you use sort of slow fluctuations in your statistics to encode the slow fluctuations in statistics of your inputs, and you use your fine time, sort of fine scale things to encode the fine scale structure of the inputs. It's an attractive picture. Now, whether that is actually used that way, in the sense that the guys down the road read it out, we have no idea. However, you can look at the structure of the spike trains, and that is true. So what I don't know is in the experiments that Fred's done in injecting currents, whether that's also true, and I have to ask him. So right, so the question is then, if I solve the problem at the level of a single cell, does a single cell also transmit something about the settings? And I...
So we saying that the information could be in the single output channel rather than in the second.
Yes. And in this case it is. So let me think about it this way, right? If I live in a world where the probability, suppose I live in a world where the probability distribution is Gaussian and the variance stays constant forever. Well, then in that case, I learn to deal with that and I leave my code alone. I don't bother adapting. If I live in a world where the variance changes every once in a while, What I want to do is make sure that since the variance only changes once in a while, I don't want to use too much of my dynamic range to code the variance, right? Because it's a waste. It's not changing very often. What I want to do is to locally make sure that most of my dynamic range is being used to encode the fine structure in a way which is adapted to the local variance. But I use the little bit that's left over, I use to code the variance itself. And so one way of thinking about that is in a separation of time scales, you mostly optimize the coding of small numbers of spikes for the local conditions. And the little mistakes you make effectively accumulate to allow the statistics on longer time scales to encode the variance. Right? Because you in some sense, you don't want to be completely optimized, because then you don't have any space left over to write down the variance, right? And actually, the truth is that I mean, this is again, so there were, you know, you asked about failings of these optimization principles. You know, has anybody ever actually sat down with any reasonable model of how you encode a signal and said, well, I have this signal which is sort of weakly non-stationary, right? Its low-order statistics are constant for epochs, and then they tend to jump to other values. What's the right way of dividing up my bandwidth between encoding the fine structure of the signal and encoding the drifting statistical parameters? But I think that's really a question the nervous system has to deal with. Whether it deals with it optimally or not, I don't know, but it would be nice to understand what the right strategy would be in principle. Long day, huh?